case for argument is Curtis v. Montgomery. Ms. Spitz.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Catherine Spitz, and I represent the appellant. Mr. Curtis is asking this Court to reverse the District Court's denial of his petition for writ of habeas corpus because the lower court unreasonably applied the clearly established federal law of Jackson v. Virginia when it sustained his conviction despite the state's failure to prove all of the elements of the aggravated stalking charge beyond a reasonable doubt. Specifically, the state failed to prove that Mr. Curtis placed the alleged victim under surveillance on at least two occasions, and it also failed to prove that he acted knowingly and without lawful justification on April 30, 2002. Your Honors, as the record shows, on April 30th, Mr. Curtis and Ms. Chester, his ex-girlfriend with whom he had a daughter, exchanged three phone calls. On two of those occasions, Ms. Chester agreed to meet with Mr. Curtis for the purpose of seeing his daughter. On the third phone call, they set up a meeting at the corner of 95th and Lafayette, a public intersection. And when Mr. Curtis arrived there a short time later, as Ms. Chester had agreed and with the assistance of police, he was immediately apprehended as he approached her vehicle where she had agreed to meet with him. The Illinois stalking statute requires that a defendant place a victim under surveillance on at least two separate occasions to sustain a conviction. The statute defines placing a person under surveillance as remaining present outside the person's residence, vehicle, or a number of other places. Mr. Curtis is not arguing for a new application of Illinois law when he points out that the state failed to adduce any evidence that he remained present outside of Ms. Chester's vehicle on April 30, 2002. Rather, the Illinois courts in other cases have emphasized that the remaining present element of surveillance requires a certain sense of physical or visual proximity. That is the rule of law in the state of Illinois, and Mr. Curtis is only asking that that was applied to the evidence that was adduced or lack thereof at his trial. The only evidence shows that when Mr. Curtis arrived where his ex-girlfriend had agreed to meet with him at the time and place where they had agreed to meet, he was immediately arrested as he approached her vehicle with the expectation of seeing his daughter. Your Honors, I submit that there is no evidence to sustain that Mr. Curtis remained present outside of Ms. Chester's vehicle given the length of time that he was present there and given that the state failed to adduce any evidence that he was there long enough to have committed any wrong. This is what distinguishes this case from People v. Daniel, which Mr. Curtis used to argue as a matter of law on earlier appeals that he could not have placed Ms. Chester under surveillance at that time. This is a distinctive argument and one that is permitted under Bates v. McCautry and Estelle v. McGuire, because the state is required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt all of the elements of aggravated stalking, including that Mr. Curtis placed Ms. Chester under surveillance on at least two occasions.
Does this have a factor, though, that how the, first of all, the state defines that and how they interpret their own law? Aren't we stuck with that?
We are, Your Honor, but I submit, Judge Mannion, that under Illinois law, because Illinois law requires a physical or visual proximity for the individual to remain present outside of a vehicle, that under the law as it stands and as defined by the state of Illinois, the state failed to produce sufficient evidence to convict Mr. Curtis beyond a reasonable doubt.
Now, did the appellate court find that they did produce sufficient evidence?
They did, Your Honor. However, the appellate court focused more on Mr. Curtis's argument that as a matter of law, he could not have placed Ms. Chester under surveillance because he was not outside of her vehicle for a sufficient period of time. I submit that because the state failed to adduce any evidence other than that Mr. Curtis was immediately arrested upon arriving at an agreed-upon meeting orchestrated by the police, that the state failed to convict him beyond a reasonable doubt of that particular element.
Is he out of prison now?
He is, Your Honor. However, under the United States Supreme Court decision in Carafee and this court's decision in Harrison versus Indiana, the fact that he has served out his sentence does not mean that his petition for habeas corpus is moot. And indeed, his petition produces several issues, the fact that he was not convicted under sufficient evidence being the one that this court has chosen to address. In addition to the fact that Mr. Curtis did not place Ms. Chester under surveillance or that the state did not prove that he did so, the state also failed to prove that Mr. Curtis acted knowingly and without lawful justification on April 30th, 2002, when he arrived at the time and place where Ms. Chester had agreed to meet with him. The only evidence in the record indicates that Ms. Chester agreed to meet with Mr. Curtis at that intersection at that time on two separate occasions via phone call. The detective who testified at the trial agreed to this as well. And the sparse evidence that was presented indicates that Mr. Curtis showed up with the intent to see his daughter on that day. The state had the burden of proving that Mr. Curtis acted knowingly with regard to all of the elements of aggravated stalking, including placing Ms. Chester under surveillance. In order, under Illinois law, to prove that Mr. Curtis acted knowingly, the state had to prove that Mr. Curtis was aware of the existence of facts that made his conduct unlawful. And in this instance, Mr. Curtis was aware of the fact that Ms. Chester had agreed to meet with him and that she had agreed to do so for the purposes of seeing their daughter. He was not aware, for example, that Ms. Chester had contacted the police. He did not have any reason to believe that she did not want to meet with him. Ms. Chester never said that she did not want to meet with him. She never threatened to call the police. She never reminded Mr. Curtis that he was subject to a protective order, and she never simply hung up the phone or otherwise indicated that she was not willing to appear where the two had agreed to meet.
What was the basis of the protective order? There must have been some abuse or something or other that caused this in the first place.
Well, Your Honor, the basis for the protective order was that at the end of Mr. Curtis's relationship with Ms. Chester, there was a lot of tension, as there was.
That's kind of a mild way of approaching it.
Yes, Your Honor, I suppose it is. But the truth of the matter is the protective order was simply stipulated to and placed into evidence at the trial.
Protective orders are not issued on the basis of tension between the parties.
Well, Judge Bauer, I suppose it would not be merely tension. However, the two had a contentious relationship, but the important...
evidence of physical violence.
That is the basis of one of the protective orders, yes, Your Honor. However, it should be noted that the protective order did not ban Mr. Curtis from seeing his daughter. There is no dispute that Jasmine Curtis was Mr. Curtis's daughter or that she is not mentioned within the protective order.
Now, is it supposed to be under some sort of supervision or a neutral place with someone else or what?
Judge Mannion?
The reason is because when we're looking, you know, the state reviewed all of this, they applied the law and all that kind of thing, and you've got to come up with something that's pretty extreme. It seems to me there is, there must be a pretty good reason to have this protective order out. And this, if it's being breached, maybe there's something else involved. Maybe he isn't paying support. I'm sure he isn't doing that. And maybe he offered to do that. There are different things that can enter into this picture that would cause something different than what you're arguing.
I understand that, Judge Mannion, but the fact remains that in the trial record, there is none of that evidence. What we have is that Mr. Curtis, you know, stipulated the protective order would be entered, but the truth remains that the state failed to prove the other elements of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. I would like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Spitz. Mr. Treble?
At this point, I think since he's out of prison, who's the proper defendant?
Sorry, Your Honor?
He's out of prison, so the...
Yes, Your Honor, he is out of prison. And good morning, Your Honor's counsel, and may it please the court. I am Assistant Attorney General Carl Treble, representing the respondent. I wanted to start by answering the last round of questions. What led to this protective order? On page 16 of the record in the Supplemental Appendix 5, or excuse me, Supplemental Appendix 3 is the appellate court's opinion, where it recited the sentencing hearing evidence. And in that sentencing hearing evidence, they went over the previous history that led to this current protective order. Defendant made bomb threats against the victim's home. Defendant looked outside of her house and saw her in her car, threatened to kill her if she called the police, and broke the glass in the front of her house. On another date, the victim saw defendant standing in her yard, called the police, and had him arrested. In October of 2001, the defendant called her over 100 times from jail, at her home and at work, threatening her that if she appeared in court against him, he would hurt or kill her.
And what was he in jail for then?
It doesn't say specifically, Your Honor. It gives the impression, though, that he was in jail for one of these acts of what the trial court characterized as terrorism against her. So, but he was in jail at that time when he made those phone calls. And again, that's on page 16 of the appellate court's opinion on direct appeal. So it wasn't that this protective order just came out of the blue. I'd also like to respond to the assertion that somehow this was merely a visitation to see his daughter. In Illinois, lawful visitation agreements are not made under the threat of death. They're made through a court order. The court order in this case prohibited defendant from making any contact at all with his victim. It didn't allow for visitation. If the defendant wanted to arrange for lawful visitation, his phone calls that day should have been to an attorney to try to get the court to give him a lawful order. Thus, the evidence was that he was acting knowing that he was in violation of a protective order. In fact, that was stipulated to a trial that he had received the order of protection that was in place at the time of his conduct. Now, as to the assertion that there was no evidence presented that he remained present at 95th Street in Lafayette, the record refutes that. Defendant arrived in his car at 95th Street in Lafayette and parked his car. At that time, he was present at the scene. He then exited his car, walked across the street towards the victim's vehicle, made a motion to her, and the motion was for her to come out of the car. So all the time after he parked at that location was remaining present. This was more than sufficient evidence to support the jury's verdict in this case. Any other evidence that the petitioner in this case feels might be necessary is calling upon a change in state law. The state appellate court held that there was no requirement that a defendant stop, stay, and wait at the scene of the crime in order to satisfy the remain present requirement under the statute. Thus, counsel's assertion that he was there for a length of time is a concession that he was within the remain present definition. If she's arguing that he needed to be there for some further length of time, that he had to stop, stay, and wait there, that's calling for this court to reinterpret state law. The state appellate court's already addressed this issue, and for this court to go any further would violate this court's prior holdings in Bates v. McCautry, which presented a similar circumstance where a defendant was arguing that a specific set of facts were necessary in order to prove an element. And Judge Easterbrook explained at that time that this was not even a federal claim, because it's up to the states to decide what are the norms necessary, what are the elements necessary to prove a crime. The only question under Jackson v. Virginia is, do the facts match up to those norms? Do the facts match up to those elements? To suggest that the defendant, as he's asserted in the state appellate court, had to stay there for some longer period of time staring at the victim in order to put her under a true threat to fall within this statute is calling for this court to add elements to the state law that are not there based on the state court's interpretation of state law. Petitioner's counsel also conceded that he was there in some type of physical proximity because petitioner admits that he pulled up to 95th Street in Lafayette. We disagree with her characterization that he was immediately arrested as soon as he pulled up to 95th Street in Lafayette. The record shows clearly, based on the uncontroverted testimony of two eyewitnesses, both Ms. Chester and one of the police officers that was there for the arrest, that he not only parked at 95th Street in Lafayette, but he also got out of his car, walked across the street, and then approached Ms. Chester's car and made a motion for her to come out of the car. That was more than enough time for a jury to determine that he had remained present to constitute this second act of surveillance under Illinois law, as so long as we accept the state court's definition of surveillance, which this court is bound to do under its own precedent. Unless there are any further...
What I started to ask earlier, what's the defendant is not the warden anymore, is it? He's not in prison?
It's unclear from this court's case law who the properly named respondent would be at this time, Your Honor. In the Supreme Court's collateral consequence cases that we cited to, they had left the named respondent as the previously named warden in that case, but it's not clear that issue was ever addressed. In Hogan v. Hanks, this court didn't offer guidance for this specific circumstance. The closest parallel that we can point to as a possible candidate for naming a properly named respondent would be the Attorney General of the state, because that's the properly named respondent where there's a risk of future custody. And, for instance, the defendant is evading arrest and is out of the jurisdiction and can't be located, and there's a risk of future arrest. In that circumstance, the Attorney General is the properly named respondent. I think that's the closest analogy, but I acknowledge that it's not a perfect analogy.
He's not on probation or supervised release or something like that now?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is he on probation or supervised release or something?
Well, he was, while this case was proceeding through the courts, through the federal courts, he initially went on to mandatory supervised release, which is when we named the director of the parole review for the Department of Corrections. And then since that time, he's exited mandatory supervised release. So he's not on any type of probation under this conviction and judgment. So under this conviction and judgment that he's attacking right now, it's unclear who the proper custodian is. And the only reason this case is not moot is because of the collateral consequences doctrine.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Dreeble.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mrs. Fitz, how much time does she have?
May it please the Court? A couple of quick points on rebuttal. First of all, the respondent's citation and even the court citation to the circumstances surrounding the original protective order do not have to do with the state's burden of proving that Mr. Curtis placed Ms. Chester under surveillance.
I know, but it's a very good question anyway, isn't it?
And I appreciate that, Judge Bow. Mm-hmm. However, Mr. Curtis conceded that there was a protective order in place,
yep.
But that does not mean that he placed an individual under surveillance. If we were to follow that logic, then we could convict a defendant of, say, vehicular manslaughter by pointing out that he threatened the eventual victim with a knife or a gun. It looks bad, but it really does not satisfy the elements under the statute or under the case law. It simply doesn't. Secondly, Mr. Curtis did not place Ms. Chester under surveillance because this is a case, unlike Bates, in which we do not have evidence that bears directly on the element in question. The remaining present element, we do not have any evidence that Mr. Curtis remained present outside of that vehicle because Mr. Curtis was dropped off in a van, according to both Ms. Chester and the detective who testified. He made it about halfway across the street, waved to her, and was placed under arrest. If that is sufficient evidence to convict an individual under a statute that requires him to remain present and case law that requires that term mean that there is physical or visual proximity, then the words remain present, which the Illinois legislature put in the statute, have lost all meaning. I submit that to the court. So, Your Honors, for these reasons and those stated in the brief, I request that this court reverse the district court.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Spitz. And you were requested to represent the defendant?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, this petitioner. So we thank you for your efforts on his behalf, and we thank Mr. Treble also.